going first with having children right now, and you were talking about that you've been getting them back into the swing of school, and kind of I assume that there's still some maybe some COVID protocol in Australia, or maybe not, I'm not sure. But what has it been like recently for you as a parent with everything?
So, interestingly enough, we at the start the Australian government last year kind of had a bit of a half-assed approach to some kind of a lockdown. But in our state in Victoria, we got really unlucky. Basically, Australia was kind of fine with like a small lockdown at the start, but then in Victoria we had this huge surge of cases. So we had to go into another really hardcore lockdown in like June, I think it was in June. So I spent the majority of last year in lockdown with the kids. I think we were in stage four for like over 100 days. It was really full on. As you can imagine, because you're experiencing it too. But it was interesting. I tried to do homeschool with the kids. My partner could still go to work, so he was going every day into work, and that kept some kind of a structure. But basically, I threw homeschool out the window because it was causing too much stress. And so we had a really nice rhythm of going for a bike ride every day, doing a lot of cooking. Casper and I made a quilt top that he designed, which was pretty cool. It's like an 8-bit link, like the original link. Yeah, I mean, like I felt pretty out of control in terms of like everything that was going on politically last year and still is in the world, and basically not having any time or space to sort of do anything about anything except for like the bare minimum of like getting through. But what basically, the only work that I made last year during lockdown were commissions, and I made some works to raffle off for different charities, which was actually great because I don't think I would have made the work otherwise, like if I didn't have that motivation. But I think doing commissions is different to having like a sort of spur of the moment, like spurt of energy just to create. But I think yeah, I think last year was very interesting. This year has been, we've been able to send the kids back to school. Daisy, my youngest, has started prep, which is the first year of primary school. I don't know what you guys call it. Do you guys call it
We
kindergarten?
call it kindergarten for some
Yeah.
reason, but yes. But I thought so. This is her very first year of
Yeah.
school. Wow.
Yeah. So they
How
call
is
it.
she?
Oh, how's she going? She's yeah, she really likes it. She's because she when Casper started in prep, she was 1 month old. So she's been going to the school every single day of her life. She was really so excited to start. And I think yeah, she's got some cute little friends, and it's just so nice to see the kids at school because they hadn't been all year last year. And we had like we still have restrictions, and we had restrictions over summer, but life has gone, you know, pretty much back to as normal as it could be here. We don't really have any cases. There was we did we had a snap lockdown a couple of weeks ago to basically make sure that, because we've got people coming back from overseas, and when and then they go into a hotel quarantine program, and so some of the workers from the hotel quarantine program will get COVID every now and then, and so they have to take precautions, but yeah, we're pretty much, you know, back to some kind of normal here, which I'm
That's great.
Yeah, I'm sorry to say to hear that you guys aren't.
Yeah, well, I live in Tennessee. I live in the most eastern tip. And so I'm right on the border of Virginia and North Carolina, but our Tennessean governor, he's very politically awful. And so his response has been, we had a lot of cases, I guess most initially over the summer, and it has gone down. But there is just a really slow response to the bare minimum. And so we've never had any really hard lockdowns here, and it's been more by state than on a national level. And so it's been interesting having friends who can't help it and have all kinds of different jobs where they're around people who maybe there's restaurants or places where they ask for no mask to be worn. They want to pretend that it wasn't happening until they absolutely had to. And then family members who didn't go through with any kind of like procedures of prevention. And my husband, my father's partner, went to this really popular beach that a lot of people here drive out to, and she got COVID and was hospitalized, and she's better now, but we still don't know the long-term effects of it. Yeah. And so it's something where a lot of people who I think are more innocent in terms of they just maybe more as in the loop of what was happening. It was kind of hard just to know how many cases there were. Like, there's a website you could go to, but it was hard to find. And so I had it easy where I work from home. And I only work part time, and my husband's job he's an independent contractor, so we had it easy. But for a lot of people, there's just all kinds of information that kind of overlapped that wasn't similar enough. So I think that harmed a lot of people. But we're finally starting to come out of it, but I think we're going to wait until second grade. Right now, Trevor's in first grade, and I never thought I'd be homeschooling him. So it's been But he is doing wonderfully. It was harder for me. And he was doing remote schooling with a teacher, and it was too stressful for me to go with someone else's schedule, I found. And mostly with my work schedule, I didn't have time just to, like, go from teaching to guiding what he was supposed to do without it being so stressful. So we had to give that up. I think we did it for, like, 6 weeks or 9 weeks or something, but it was hard just to be like, I don't want to take him away from his friends, even though they're just Zoom friends, but I don't know. So he's had play dates and things, at least.
Yeah. I think it's really hard. It's like, I also never imagined that I would homeschool. I really like, I like sending my kids off to school, and I think that, like, having that space as a parent, especially because we don't live in, you know, even like the way that my parents grew up, like, I'm pretty sure that they would have been out of the house and, like, on the streets, like, playing. Now we have to have our kids, you know, being watched by either us or somebody else 24/7. And so I think that having them at school feels like a necessity for anyone with a job or a practice, or even just somebody who needs, you know, their own space. But
nice for the kids just to be around different personalities and different people. I feel like I don't know, I've been a school teacher in person, and I'll probably do it in the future once my youngest gets big enough and I'll go back to working. But there's so much that they learned just from the playground, just from playing. So many different types of, like, of backgrounds and cultures that they wouldn't be exposed to, and it's really cool. So it's hard when that's not there for them. So
it really is. It is. And it's like they're learning how to get along with other people in society, even when they may not be from the same sort of, you know, family is now the same sort of place, or yeah, I think at school's really important. It felt very weird last year not having that. But I mean, like, my Casper is very sweet and gentle and responsible, and so I didn't have a super hard time with him at home. Like, he and Daisy were awesome. Although he is entering into his like tween years.
Mm-hmm. What grade is he in? Is it fifth grade?
Grade five, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so he's turning 11 this year, and we've had a few moments where he will be defiant of whatever's going on, or it'll either be that he'll be defiant or of like a boundary that I've put down, or he will, I guess it's the same thing. I think that's a natural thing that kids, they do it to feel secure, I think.
Yeah.
But it really, really, like, especially when you're not having a break from it. There were a few moments in lockdown where I'm sure the street heard some yelling from both sides.
Like, Strummer's really sweet, and he's seven, but there are moments where there's something he just didn't want to do at that time. Or maybe I was being pushy with, like, we had the next assignment and it was due, or like just something with like going too fast paced, and he would slam the door, and like that happens because yeah. they're around no matter how much they love their family. And I see that with your kids, they just seem so loving to each other, there's so much love to you guys too. They just look so happy. But aww, even the happiest people, it's hard it's hard. And I love being home, and I'm super introverted. It takes energy for me to go out if there's a big gathering or an art reception, and I love doing those things, but I have to retract, and like I super miss doing that, and I didn't think I'd miss it as much, but enough time has gone by. So
I think that's, yeah, it's weird. And I think also as parents who are artists, you're used to missing out on events, and like I feel like when I had Casper, a lot of my friends were just graduating from one of the art schools in Melbourne, and that was like a period of time where a lot of them were being invited to be in shows, and then having shows, like having group shows, sort of DIY sort of whatever, or like artist run initiative shows, and like there were a lot of shows that I just couldn't go to because I was at home with Casper, or I was just too tired or whatever.
Like, yeah,
I feel like in the last few years, you know, now that my kids are getting bigger, I've been able to go out to more things, so and like meet more artists and sort of engage a bit more with the art world in real life. It's actually been funny. Well, maybe not funny. It's been interesting watching other people who haven't been isolated socially before, navigating like the lockdown and navigating having to communicate with people or like show their art practice online. Because I'm so used to doing that, I didn't really, well, I actually kind of retreated a little bit from social media this year because I felt, I don't know, I felt as though it was like, yeah, I'm not sure why. I think I felt like,
I think it's felt more intense for sure.
Yeah.
And like, I know I've had more friends that took breaks this year than have happened previously. And I think it's like where there are people, whether it's non-creative people who haven't been isolated before, or if it's creative people like you're saying who are adapting, it can be a lot to have so much more, or to spend more time I guess having like just like more of an influx of information or an influx of content and imagery. And I don't know, I think like what you're saying, it's something that I was prepared for because I just had Opal and I started using like the pickup orders for groceries, like all these things that we have where you don't have to go in person. I'm like, this is so great. I love this. Not realizing that this would be what I would be doing like for now a whole year. And so I was getting into that groove and I started using Instagram after I had Strummer's, my first time I had a smartphone, and that was my social life for a long time. Because, like you're saying, there's too many factors into being able to do things. But when everyone's doing it, it can feel a little maybe just claustrophobic. And it's not that you don't want to see those things, but so much at once, I think. I don't know.
I think you hit the nail on the head. I think that probably the experience of parenthood and like that really little kid stage, and especially like you and me having kids in this decade and having social media and being connected but isolated at the same time, I think it probably made us a little bit more resilient to the lockdown and like how that feels. But yeah, oh, not the lockdowns, whatever, the isolation of COVID. I mean, yeah, it's I've been interested in the ways that people have navigated that new landscape, especially in the art world, and like the way that yeah, the way I think people have sort of popped out a little bit more on the internet or something. Like it both interests me and it also makes me want to step away. As you said, I think there is something claustrophobic about it.
Well, and I wanted to ask because I remember seeing when you've I think you said you've done multiple raffles where you were raising money. Wow, okay.
I'm working on a piece for another one. I just haven't had that much time.
Oh, cool. Well, and what I love is, and I feel like with your work anyway, certain people's work seems to translate better for social media, or is able to, not better than a gallery, but I feel like that's harder to do with something like fiber work. But with the type of imagery that you work with, and there's something that's graphic about it, but there's also so much detail to it, and there's so much like conceptual imagery where you're working with the cartoon figures and the way you work with motion. It's so vibrant and so cool. So I love every time if I'm scrolling, I have to stop and see what it is. But I wanted to ask about the raffles. Were they all for Australian relief for wildfires, or was it for different?
So the first one was for so there's there basically there's a company called Adani that they want to build a massive coal mine up in the north of Australia, and they're just so evil and so disgusting, and I'm like really it's been, I think I went to quite a few protests. I think the first Adani protest I went to was like 8 years ago, and they're still pushing. They've got really nasty connections in politics. They are trying to put to they're trying to mine coal on like sacred Indigenous land, and it's just wrong. Nobody wants it, except for the few who are going to make money from it. It's so disgusting. Anyway, I felt very upset because they just kept pushing through. People are still battling them legally, but basically at that point last year, I felt so upset that I couldn't do anything. Like I couldn't go and protest anywhere or do anything. And I saw that there was like a legal fund for them to fight it. So I thought, maybe I'll just try one of, because I've seen other people doing raffles. And I thought, you know, like if I could make like $150 or something, then that would be great. Because last year we were on quite a low income. I basically couldn't afford to donate myself. But I think we raised almost $1,000 with that one, which was great. Wow. And like, I think it's just like, you know, people are going to donate to stuff anyway. They may as well be in the winning in the running to win an artwork. So it's been great. And then the next one I did was for the Japurung trees, which is closer to where I live. It's about two and a half hours away. It's a sacred birthing tree site where they've got these beautiful old trees where the indigenous people of the area, the women would give birth in the trees.
Oh, wow.
It's like such a beautiful, important, sacred site, and the local government are wanting to put a highway extension through it, which is...
That's awful. Irreplaceable.
It's just like Captain Planet. It's like an episode of Captain Planet. Like, you know what I mean? Like, it's just evil environmental destruction for the sake of being, like, violent. But there have been people up there defending the land, but since the lockdowns, no one's been able to go up, and they've also been, because... Basically, I don't know. They've basically just been trying to get at people any way that they can. So they've been like picking people up from the camps who have got like overdue fines and putting them in jail and like that sort of thing. That one I think we raised about $1,000 for two, which was awesome.
Wow. And that's then
the
so
third
cool.
one was for an org called Black Rainbow, which is LGBTQI+ organization for Indigenous people. And like there's so many fantastic organizations that I would just love to raise money for. And it's a little bit weird. I feel a little bit weird. The reason why it took me such a long time to sort of do something like a raffle was because I didn't really want to make it about me or my work or whatever, but I realized when I did it was that actually because I don't have anything else to offer, right? Like I can't offer my time, I can't offer my body, I can't offer my like money. I didn't have any money last year. I don't really have that much money this year. It was a really good way of putting what I could out, really.
Oh, I think that
you overthink things sometimes, though.
Right.
You know?
Well, I feel like the fact that you thought about the different angles of it, it shows that you're doing it from a place that has empathy and thoughtfulness, because when people are seeing the imagery or they're seeing like what the raffle is for, you're teaching them about different types of charities that they probably may not have known about. These are charities that I hadn't known about. And these are super important causes. And so I think that takes precedence. I would never see that and think that it was like a vanity or anything. And I love that I can just tell, I don't know. I've talked to quite a few artists. I think every artist I've talked to so far, there has been like an activism theme like running through. And it's something that I wish everybody that it was just like natural to just be like, okay, what can I do? But there's a lot of, I know if I think of people who are in my family, there's a lot of people who are on the other side who support things like coal mining, or they support a lot of political things that are just only causing oppression. So it makes a big deal for other people and for your children to see that you're talking about or giving something, donating something, because that is still your time and that's your expertise and your experience from being an artist and your using your voice. And so I think it's so cool. And I think that the amount of money that you raised is definitely put a dent into what they were hoping to raise, I'm sure. So I
Yeah.
love that. But
Oh, thank you. Thanks. Yeah, I'm so glad that I'm so glad that it's raised awareness of, some smaller organizations. I think also it's a good prompt for people to realize that maybe they can, donate $10 or, maybe, I mean, lots of people can't though, and that's actually also absolutely fine. But I think there's a lot of people who don't realize that like a donation, a small donation once every, week or month actually does make a difference. But it's nice to see like a collectivist sort of like when you actually put something together and then show people how much they've all raised together, it makes everybody feel really good.
yes, I think so. I agree. And with your kids, you mentioned that Casper, and I've seen drawings that he's made, but you've mentioned that he's helped or has been learning about fiber work too.
Yeah.
So I would love to ask you, I guess, where like your artistry kind of overlaps with your child rearing, like, are there things that you've kind of taught or that things that you've seen your kids do that are creative that you think are maybe a reflection of them being around, or even with activism too? Are there like causes or things that they're asking about or thinking about?
Well, I think the main thing is my studio is at home and it has been at home for, I mean, since we've lived here, 10 years. I am always working in my studio around the kids and like sometimes it sort of spills out. Sometimes it's like on the kitchen table and they have to eat somewhere else or whatever. But I will just let the kids go, free range in the studio every now and then. I don't let them just play willy-nilly in the studio because it's pretty dangerous. But I'll give them like a needle and thread and some scrap fabrics. And like Daisy, I think it was during lockdown, I was filming her making this beautiful, like these beautiful birds. Like she was just basically tacking scrap fabric together until it made a shape and
Oh,
then
cool.
sewing like buttons on. And she did such a beautiful job, and it's so important for their hand-eye coordination and like what's it called? It's the pincer. What is
I know, I
it
can't
called?
remember.
It's
Right.
a pincer grip development in like little kids. But Casper does the same thing. He'll pick up a needle and thread and sort of it's not so much like technical sewing work, but it's more like a tacking process. But I don't want to put any pressure on them to like learn how to sew and be perfect. I just want them to enjoy it. And that's what my dad taught me how to sew, and he put a sewing machine in my room when I was about
Cool.
11, maybe younger, 8, 9, 10, something like that. And he showed me how to use it, and then I was allowed to use it whenever I wanted. That's how I learned how to sew. I actually really think like there's a lot of people who maybe know the basics of sewing or, have a sewing machine, but are intimidated because of the way that they learnt, or maybe that they think that they need to be perfect. But I think it's actually just really about playing and like, yeah, I feel lucky that I wasn't raised in that way. Like, I think I was sort of raised to play. Both of my parents are artists.
Oh,
My mum's
cool.
more of a writer now, but I grew up in a family where there was always music and art and like beautiful books and beautiful food and beautiful people around. So I think I've tried to replicate that in my own family. And I think, I mean, we've done a really good job. We have so many beautiful family, friends, and just creative people around. And I think my kids are going to have no choice but to be, you know, artists in some way or another.
Yeah. Well, and I'd love to ask about some of the imagery that you work with, or maybe just fiber art in general, since you started so young. What were some of the, maybe some of the earliest things that you made, and what age were you when you started to realize what was maybe more, what you were most interested, I guess, in depicting, or maybe what kind of techniques or just kind of processes that you felt like were meant more for you, how that came about?
Well, that's a really interesting question. I think I was making sort of stuffed toys when I was a kid. My dad sort of taught me how to draft patterns from like copying things.
Oh, cool.
So I think I always had this idea, this 3D, this natural ability to understand how to make a 3D pattern or how to draft a pattern. But when I was probably about 15, I started making my own clothes, and I was just deeply obsessed with sewing and making my own patterns and copying patterns and just making, like, you know, whatever my brain could conjure up. But I think when I was in the last years of high school, I was pretty interested in quilt making, and I think I made my first, well, I actually made my first quilt with my grandma.
Oh, cool.
When I was a kid. But I think the first quilt that I made was maybe in year 12, in the last year of high school. And it's just like a little patchwork quilt with a embroidery on it. But I made that for my art folio. But my teachers were not that impressed.
Oh, wow.
I also made a ventriloquist dummy.
Oh, cool.
My concept for my year 12 folio was that the ventriloquist dummy was like a real baby and, or like a real kid. And then I made all of the,
That's so fun.
I made the quilt and like the booties and the little matinee jacket and the dress. And I got a stroll, like a toy stroller.
Oh,
and I
cool.
covered it with like a floral towel, like all of this sort of stuff. But my teachers were not, I think it wasn't exactly what they were expecting from me. But anyway, I think it's a pretty cool idea.
For it to be in high school, I think that's so impressive and so cool.
Yeah, I thought it was pretty cool. I mean, yeah, I'm not sure if I got the greatest marks in high school art, but anyway, I always knew that I was going to go to art school and like have an art practice. I always thought, like, I don't have like these ideas that, I don't have an idea that I want to be like, you know, famous or recognized or anything. I just would be so happy to have like a little art practice that is ongoing for my whole life. Like I don't even know the last time I was in an art show. I haven't even had a show since 2018, I think.
Well, I feel like a lot of people, there's such a drive for people to talk about things or to have the expectation of things to, I guess, to have a notoriety or whatever,
yeah.
Or to have like a certain following. And I remember being in college and a friend being like, what are you going to do if you can't be an artist? And that just like blew my mind. And I'm like, I'm always going to make, yeah. And whatever they meant, and I'm sure it had to do with whatever, like, particular increment of money or increment of being known or whatever. But I remember just being like, no, I've always have loved making things, and I'll always will find some way to do something. And I remember them just saying like, oh, like you're going by like the, what is it called, where it's like self-fulfilling prophecy or something. I'm just like, no, like I'm just gonna make stuff, like, but they're still, and that was like years ago, and that was I think before social media, maybe Facebook existed. But there's some artists who I love their work that I follow, but then maybe time goes by and it doesn't happen too often, but it's like suddenly it feels more about like the whole branding thing. Like it can get too extreme. And I understand if people have, maybe they want to have a page that's just for like their film work or something, or maybe they are getting some kind of a job where they need to have us more streamlined. Like that's understandable, but some of the wording or the dialogue around it to me makes it so, it's that part is so disappointing and stressful. So it's like if you're gonna be an artist, you can be one. And that's the most important part of it anyways, is to make something if it makes you feel fulfilled. But I don't know.
I think people have this idea of, like being an artist as somebody who, has a studio and is in shows and is like hanging out with other artists all the time. And I mean, that's an image that's sold to us by the high art world. But actually, there are people who have consistent and like prolific art practices, and nobody knows who they are, and they hang out with, whoever's in their neighborhood. And like, I don't know, I grew up in a pretty like gorgeous little bubble of like artists and musicians and actors and other people who maybe did wouldn't call themselves artists, but like I probably would say that their lives were pretty creative. But I think there's lots and lots of ways of being creative and getting that fulfillment. Like I haven't my studio is a huge mess at the moment, and I haven't really made any work properly in a while, but and I'm talking like a couple of months, but like I've been doing little sketches here and there and like looking at stuff and thinking about stuff. Taking notes in my phone is like a big thing for me. Like I'll write down ideas. And in a lot of ways, like I think those lists of ideas are really fulfilling creative practice as well.
I think so too, that there's like the quote, I think it's Joe Strummer, the who I named my son after. He says something where something to do with input output, where it's like it's just as important, if not more important, to take things in before you go back to making things, whether it's visual art or music or anything. And I feel like for me it's driving. Like I always have my most favorite ideas come to me if I'm driving, but like
Driving.
taking notes and things, that's so important, because otherwise I don't know. I had so much time when I was in art school and I didn't have any kids, and I made so much crap because I wouldn't take the time to write things down or to take notes at that time. And I was just making things just because, and for whatever reason, I did that way too much, where it was just like impulsive, and for what I was making, that wasn't good. I think for some artists that can be important to experiment. But for me, that took too much precedence, and I made so much awful stuff and wasted so much. Like it was just an abundance, and I still make awful stuff, but it's definitely more considered. And I think, I don't know, I love that part. I think that might be one of my favorite parts, is making notes. And even if it's just like a quote or something, and you know that it ties in with a bigger idea, there's something really like magical about it. So.
Well, I think it, I mean, as you said, making awful stuff, I think everybody probably feels that they make awful stuff. I was speaking to my neighbor, her name's Janina, Janina Green. She's like a teacher at the art school in Melbourne, BCA, and a beautiful artist, a photographer. But she was saying that she put some work in a show recently, and she felt like it was so messy and ugly, and she felt so uncomfortable that she had to leave. She had to leave the gallery at the opening. And I was like, but that's the best. That's when you know the work is the best, is when you feel really uncomfortable about other people seeing it. You know, like when you make something and it's uncomfortable and ugly and like you don't feel good about it. That's the work that years later you'll look at and you go, oh, I was really onto something there, and I really like this is actually really good. I always am wary of if I like a work straight away as soon as I make it. I'm always really wary of that feeling, because I know that down the line I'll probably think that's a really safe work and that's a really boring work to look back on for me. The ones that like actually make me uncomfortable and like I don't want to show anyone, those are the ones that years later I'll look back and I'll be like, oh my god, I can't believe that I thought this was awful, you know. Right.
I think that's really smart, because there needs to be some type of risk involved, whether it's something that's more personal or more vulnerable, and again that could be from how it looks and not necessarily about the context, or it can be a number of things. So I think that's really a really cool way of describing it, what you just said. And a lot of people don't, I think a lot of people, if they go to art school, they either lose that maybe, or at least like there's been times where I have, where it's just like it takes time, I guess, to go back to where you don't have critiques and you don't have like as much feedback maybe. So it's like a little bit more unknown, but it's good. Yeah. But it's like your first time sometimes is not until it's on a gallery wall where someone says something and it's like, oh my god, I never saw that before or something. It's always interesting. And I don't know, I know like with my mom, every time she saw my work she would only say cute, and that's all I would ever get. And so it's always better, and there's nothing wrong with that, but it's always better to have the feedback that's different kinds of opinions, because that's the most valuable. So
yeah, I think that's one of the things that is really missing from the internet and art communities on the internet, and even art communities after you leave school. Like, the things about school is that you've got people who are constantly interacting with your work. They're really familiar with what you're working on and what you're doing, and they're coming around and walking into your studio and looking at your stuff, or they're talking about your stuff and critiques. And like, that's a really great, it's like being in a growth mindset all the time, and also taking risks. Like, you do see a lot of artists who fall into a very comfortable sort of rhythm of making basically the same aesthetic for years and years and years. And I think, I mean, I don't know, it's probably more about people having less time to explore things, and they're finding like a, you know, a place where they feel comfortable expressing themselves. Mm-hmm. But I think it would be really interesting to have like some kind of an online critique space, whether or not it's a group or whether it's just like a bunch of strangers, although I imagine that the anonymity of the internet would probably make that into a pretty unsafe space.
Right. It's hard.
But like, even if you had like a group of people who got together and I mean, I'm sure people are already doing it, but yeah, I think I really miss that. I miss that about school, and I miss that about you know, having work in shows. Is people talking about it, people asking you about what things mean and how you make things and stuff, you know, because you don't get to do that. On the internet, people see it for about 2 seconds, like it, and then comment some fire emojis or whatever and then leave.
Yeah, it's true. And I know, like, I've had friends who started, like, art collectives after school, and There have been some experiences that were really cool where we would try to have critiques, and I think we had a couple that were successful, but I remember it was really hard just to pull everyone together and to have like the time that worked. And I had one, it was in the basement of the last house I lived at. We had people bring over work, but there was still a lot of reticence where some people, and it was mostly people that were familiar with everybody. So it was people who like went to school together, which is really important. But there's still people that only wanted to say things that they felt were kind, whatever that meant to them. And that was years ago. And it was like pulling teeth just to organize it. And then I remember how good it felt. And then that was really the last time I had any kind of a critique experience. And it's like you're just kind of out in the ocean. Like you don't really know what people think because they won't say it online. And I've had friends that have dropped by my home studio and they'll see something and it's always just like, oh, that looks so cool or that looks so good. And that's all it ever is, which is completely understandable. And it's also like I don't want to put them on the spot, but it's hard for people to be honest or to maybe they haven't seen your work for a long time and they don't know where to begin. So it's really difficult to find that space again after school. And I read that you went to school in Montreal, is that right? Which is
I
so
did.
cool. I've been there. I took Strummer there for 2 weeks a couple
I
years
remember
ago,
you
and
messaged me and I was like, I'm not there anymore.
yes, but I wanted to ask what your experience was like there, and then I would also like to ask then about your painting that you picked because I can see some overlap with the art historical selection and with some of the imagery that you've used, but if you want to share about that.
When I finished high school, my granddad had put a little bit of money aside for me when I turned 18, which was so generous and lovely, and it really opened my possibilities up for what I could do, as a new adult. And so I decided that instead of going to art school here in Melbourne, that I would try my hand at living somewhere else. And so I didn't really do that much research on Montreal. I just thought, like, French-speaking city in like Canada, that sounds awesome. So I applied at Concordia and I got in and I went, and it was probably one of like the most out there and like I don't want to say brave because I think it's not super brave to get money from your grandparents and like go and live overseas, but like it was probably one of the more like confident moves that I've made in my life. And I mean, it's actually just brazen, really, because like I didn't know anything. I mean, like I was a baby. I think I was 19 when I got there. I made so many friends. I like would walk up to people on the street and be like, "Hi, I just moved here. Do you want to be my friend?" Like
That's
fully,
so cool.
just completely like. I don't know. I guess maybe I just wasn't really that afraid of rejection, because I was like anonymous, like nobody knew who I was. I'm still like very, very good friends with a lot of the people that I met during that time. I lived in Montreal for 2 years, so I went to art school for 1 year and then I deferred. And then I lived for another year and I was a nanny. For
Oh,
this beautiful
cool.
family. But yeah, it was just the most amazing city. And like it was 2008 and 2009. So like there was just so much cool stuff going on, like so many cool people. It was a real, like, I think it is that kind of transient city where young people move to it. It was super cheap. Like I was getting by. In my second year that I was living there, I was getting by on like $200 a week, which
That's
was
amazing.
rent, food. I mean, like pretty broke all the time, but like that's amazing.
That's now a I'm whole like, city. I don't know.
Yeah, God, my budget now is, I mean, I've got kids and life is complicated, but I don't know. I just think like it was a really amazing time to live there. I met so many beautiful people. I really got my ass kicked at art school, which was great because I think I felt very sort of safe and like, you know, I already knew everything that I wanted to know about art when I got there. And my teachers really sort of pushed me to have a bit more of a growth mindset and think about less about arriving at a place and more about, you know, like the way that you're going to develop your work to get to the supposed like end, you know,
right,
the finish line, which I don't think you ever get to. I don't think when you're making art, you should probably never get to any sort of a conclusion about anything. you should probably always be striving to like find out more or to explore more or to play more. But it was invaluable. Like I still draw on a lot of my experiences from that time when I'm making work, and even I don't know, even when I'm trying to decide what to do next with my life and what to do next with my, you know, relationships with my family and friends. And I'm so glad that I did that, and it really enriched everything that's come after. What was the other question? Oh, the Hans Holbein painting.
Yes. Well, and I want to mention, though, I do think that you were incredibly brave. I think we must be the same age, because I was a teenager that time too. And I feel like it's really important for people, if they're able to, or when they're able to visit other countries, to feel free to do that and to go to school. And that's something that I'm sure that your grandfather must have been so proud of to pick that, to do the money, or how to use the money. I think that that's like the best outcome. So I don't think it's just brazen. I think it's a multitude of super cool, but it's a choice that maybe a lot of teens might not have made. So it's amazing that you were able to do that and to know like that you wanted certain types of things out of it, that you wanted to learn, and you were there to obtain as much knowledge as you could. So I love that. But yes, so that I wanted to ask you about, or this like why you picked this painting. And I'm curious about the imagery, and maybe if you feel like there's any ties to your work or not. And if not, that's fine too. But
well, I picked this painting because it's something that I think about a lot. My parents took me and my brother on a family trip in 2005, I think, to America and Europe. My dad had never been, actually both of my parents, my mom had been to Europe when she was a kid, but my parents had never been as adults. And these are people who studied art, who are artists. And so we spent the whole time going to galleries, and it was like walking through these galleries with people who knew these paintings so well, but had never seen them in real life. And I can't remember where we saw the ambassadors, but when my dad turned the corner in the gallery and saw it, it was like a religious moment. Like he was so moved, and he was like, this is like the most incredible painting. I can't believe I'm seeing, he was like, look at the greens. Like, look at the fur. Like he couldn't believe it. And it was one of the moments that stood out to me the most, because as we were looking at the painting, he was like, and now look at the skull at the bottom of the painting. And I was like, what? And then realizing that this painting's like 500 years old and it's got an anamorphic skull stretched out at the bottom and standing at the point that the gallery has marked out on the floor to look at it in, you know, perspective, or look at it to create the optical illusion, and just thinking this is wild, and this is like the pinnacle of like you know, human in like achievement in art. Right. I couldn't believe it. And I've thought about that painting for my whole life since that moment. And a few years ago, I was thinking about it and I thought, why did he do that? Like, why did he paint that skull? And like, how old was he when he did it? Blah, blah, blah. So I did some research online and I couldn't find out why he painted the skull. All I could really find out was that he had, like, the entire painting is full of symbolism and like it's just like a very important painting in general, but the only thing that I could find about why he painted the skull was basically that he wanted to show people that he was shit hot at painting and that he was really clever.
Yes, I right? think it worked.
Yeah. And so also I found out that he knew that the painting was going to be hung on a stairway. So he painted the skull so that people would be walking up the stairs and they would be looking from the angle that he's even painted it so that it's stretched out on an angle where you'd be looking at it from below or above on the stairs. So I was like, that is so funny that like this really, really important painting, this like incredible like feat of like, you know, optical illusion and just technical painting that's so old is just this young dude showing off. Right. So then that's sort of when I started to think about doing the stretched out like cartoon patchwork. So like that's the sort of idea for that was basically that I wanted to have a solo show and I wanted everyone to think that I was really good. And I was sort of playing on that, this idea of Hans Holbein the Younger being like, it's my time to shine. I'm doing this painting. I know where it's going to be hung. I'm just going to like show everyone that I am, you know, the best. And so not that I think that I'm the best. I was just sort of thinking about like the ego of young people and like how far can you push your technical ability? How impressed can you make other people with you? You know, like how wacky can you, like, can you push something out to be like wacky and impressive and whatever. But I also was using fussy cutting techniques, which is like this patchwork technique that was popularized in the 1800s where you pick out like very specific parts of patterned fabric and then you repeat them. So I was like combining this, you know, egotistical Hans Holbein the Younger skull and then fussy cutting and putting them together. But it was a great show. That show had two really big quilts and then I think about 11 or 12 smaller quilts, which were just the stretched out anamorphic cartoon patchwork things. And I put that show on myself. Actually, I got a retail space and just rented it out. And then I paid for it by having quilt making workshops and patchworking workshops in them. It was really great. It was fantastic. Like I sat the show the whole time. Like I sat in the space and people came through, which was awesome because I could talk to everyone about my work. But yeah, that's the whole origin of that.
That's so cool. I was hoping, and that wasn't, it was a painting that I was familiar with and you see it like in art history textbooks. And my husband saw it when I think it was in London is where it was at. Mm. How old were you when you saw it?
I was 15.
Wow. That would have blown my mind because again, even like you're saying with the skull being like, the thing that's like revealed if you don't know about it and you look at everything else first, because like you're talking about with the color or this with the realism and the texture, like you have like the metal of like the different like globes and like these statues and you have a crucifix and then they have the clothing, everything is so perfectly rendered. And so, but I didn't know about the stairwell, and because I know it has a diagonal angle, so that makes sense.
Yeah.
But I didn't realize that aspect.
You have to kind of you have to kind of bend, you have to kind of like kneel down to see it properly.
That's so cool. But so I was, when I was revisiting it yesterday, and I was like, immediately thought about your, the cartoons that you quote with. So I was hoping that's what it was. But it also makes me think, because this, the pop cultural aspect of working with imagery that's really well known, for you to use that in such a particular way, in the way that you're cutting it out and the process, it just reminds me of when we have people, if it's like a well-known cartoon, or if it's like a pop star or something that like a lot of people know about, there has to be a lot of confidence to kind of bear the weight of that costume, or of that music, or if it's a cartoon even, and you have like the voice actors, there's always so much confidence and this kind of saturation of like the senses, which I love. So I feel like your work has that, where it's like you wanna look at it to kind of figure it out and decide like the motion of like where you're supposed to maybe look first, or to kind of follow the patterns or the colors a certain way. So it has that same feeling that I got from that painting. So that's so cool to hear you tie it together like that. So that's really cool. Yeah. And then I wanted to ask you about your movie pick, because again, there's some surreal qualities with the way this movie was made, even without talking about just how deep the layers are with the characters and the story. But why does this film stand out to you, and how old were you when you first watched this?
So Heavenly Creatures, I think my mum, so we have this running joke that in our family we have a horror gene. My granddad was a huge ghost story, horror movie loving guy, and my mum loves scary shit, and me and my brother, just since, I mean, like, as soon as I could watch Arachnophobia when I was like 10 years old, I was hooked. Like, right. I was so excited to watch scary stuff. And I think my mum asked me when I was like 14 or 15, oh my God, have you seen Heavenly Creatures? And I was like, no, what is it? And she was like, it's a true story about, you know, two girls who plot to kill, you know, I mean, spoiler alert, but not really.
It's fine.
They sort of plot to kill one of the girls' mothers. And, like, I just couldn't believe, like, I couldn't believe the story. But then also when I watched the movie, the world that you're sort of transported into, and it's Melanie Lynskey and Kate Winslet, and they're just both such fantastic actors still. Like, how amazing that that's probably both of their first.
I think it is, roles, yeah.
The proper role.
Incredible.
And they're amazing. And, like, they both bring this sort of raw, like, teenage energy to the film. And also, like, I think it was one of the first times that I actually just really, like, I don't know, I really just felt like they were real characters, like real teenage girl characters. It's such a rich visual and, like, I don't know, creative world that Peter Jackson, you know, made for them to. I mean, like, I think it's just, for me, it's like one of the most perfect films, and like I would watch it over and over again. I tried to get it last night, but none of the streaming services in Australia have it.
It was hard to find. I had to watch like just like YouTube clips and things, but I need to buy it, because I didn't realize how the way that it's edited even, but how surreal. Where they really weave in the inner world that they are creating together, which is so cool.
They You're working from Pauline's actual diary,
Right.
which is, I think, I mean, I'm pretty sure. Oh man, maybe now that
I
I
think
say
they
that.
are. No, I think
Yeah.
you're right.
But like how, I don't know. I just think it combines that like can't look away horror of something just so absolutely like awful happening of like true crime with this fantasy world of like, I mean, they're kind of in like this folie a deux, like psychosis together. And they're, I don't know, it's for me, I feel like it's just the perfect mix of this like whimsical, made up world with like this sharp edge of horror. It's, I don't know,
Totally.
it's probably one of my favorite movies of all time. Yeah.
And I feel
But I think,
like, oh, you go
yeah, you
ahead.
go on.
Well,
You go on.
I feel like, again, I was amazed too that this was such a early, because it's also, I think, Peter Jackson's one of his earliest. Is it his very first
I
movie?
don't
Maybe
know.
I'm wrong about
Would
that.
be early.
I think he had done like horror shorts. Maybe he had done a feature length too. But this is like the one that really put him on the map and become more well known, as far as I know. So there's like a lot of youth involved and talent involved, which kind of mirrors the story. And then just knowing that these women are alive and went on to live these normal lives without many people. Or at least at the time, maybe since the film, it might have changed. Without people knowing who they were, they could change their name and just move on.
Yeah.
It just
Well,
makes it more crazy.
one of them became a I think it was Juliet became a Kate Winslet's character became a like a murder mystery writer, didn't she?
Yeah. And there's like
Which
a
is
pen
just
name, and
wild.
it's
Yeah, she has a
super.
pen name.
And I think the other one has runs like childcare or something to do
Oh
with
my
children,
God.
or it was like an after school program, something to do with education and young children. So it's like, and it's like I'm, sh and of course, like they were kids when it happened, but that's the whole blurry thing is that how much of it was really innocent and how much of it are they guilty of? Because it's,
Yeah.
I don't know. And then the fact that they were referring to themselves as heavenly creatures, it makes me think of artists like Henry Darger or like outsider artists where they made things that they began to believe were worlds, but like becoming more enveloped in these worlds. And it
Yeah.
happens more easily if you're a teenager because that's your way of having some freedom or some independence. But what a strange outcome
I
of what they
know.
did, but
I
I don't know.
know. Well, I remember being that age and I had such a, like beautiful friendship group and we were so, I mean, we were just out all weekend in running around the city and like, trying to do, crazy stuff like, drinking in parks and drawing on the sidewalk with chalk and like just stupid teenage things. But like I can see how easily you could slip into this sort of dangerous made up world at that age if you didn't have like the tethers of, parents who know where you are and what you're doing. And like I think it's really easy to get swept up into stuff like that at that age. And it's such an interesting age to be. I think they were like 15, right?
I think so.
I
Yeah.
watched it at that time. And I think Kate Winslet, like, I don't know. I thought Kate Winslet's character was just, divine. And Melanie Lynskey does such an amazing job of playing Pauline. I don't know. It's just such a fantastic movie. I think everybody should watch it at least once.
Yeah, and the fact that they did it from Pauline's perspective just heightened the outsider perspective because of her I guess where her family really came from less money than the Kate Winslet character, I think. And so there's also like that, like looking in where, and like no matter what your family's income is, when you're a teenager, you feel like that you're part of something that's on the outside. Depending on if you're able to find a friend group, or if you do, then they become so important to you because it's such a unique experience to be that age together and to have all these things going on and trying to figure things out at the same time. And so I like that they did that. They really like pushed that perspective of the teenager like mind and how hard it can be, but also how like magical it can feel too. So well, cool. Well, I wanted to ask before we go, and of course I'll share links and things too, but if people want to see more of your artwork, how can they find you? And also, I think, are you part of an art collective as well?
Are you talking about Piecework Collective?
I think so. That might be.
So I suppose I am. So Piecework Collective is like a show that happens once every year. They didn't have one. Maybe they've actually taken a break for the last couple of years, but it's a quilt. It's like a quilt show of quilt makers from all around, mainly the US. But there are people at the head of the collective who just basically choose who they want in the show each year. So yeah, Piecework Collective is fantastic, and you can check them out online. I'm not sure what the website is, but I'm sure if you just write Piecework Collective into your search engine, you'd get it. I am working on my website at the moment. It's been down for a while, but it's rubyhoppin.com. I'll try and make sure that it's up by the time this comes out.
Oh, that's totally...
I needed somebody to light a fire under my butt to do it because I've been paying for it, but I haven't. It's so easy to lose money in that way. Like, it's just ridiculous. Anyway, I really actually only have stuff up on Instagram. I've got my like old blog from when I was like a teenager on Blogspot.
Oh, cool.
But yeah, Instagram's the main place that I post my art stuff. I am probably going to be working towards having a solo show this year. I think I'm going to do it in a sort of DIY way again, like just find an empty retail space and convince the real estate agent to give it to me for cheap and then pay for it by having workshops or something, that sort of a vibe. But I hopefully will have my website up and running. This is me like trying to figure out if I have the brain space to do it, but I think I do. I think I should. I need it. Yeah, Instagram's one thing, but website's a different thing.
I love it either way. I haven't seen your work in person. Maybe someday I would love to, but I feel like the use of color that you do within your work, and I haven't even talked about just everything that you do because you're also an accomplished painter. I love, because you're a figurative painter, and there's a really specific way that you depict figures that has kind of a Renaissance feeling, I feel like, but they also feel really contemporary. And then I love your QR code quilts too. Those are so cool. So there's so many, but there's a lot of reference to like optical illusion and art historical references that I think are really, it's cool to see the way that you mix that, and it feels so contemporary and so vibrant. There's just so much vibrant color too. So even this on Instagram, I feel like it translates really well, and I can't, it's not fair for me to say that because I haven't seen it in person, but I'm just going to assume that it does. So
Well, I mean, that's the presentation on Instagram is how I choose to represent my work online. So that's like the ultimate compliment, I think. And like, I think I have work that does translate pretty well via, photograph, even if it is fiber work. I think like, I mean, also painting, but yeah, I think seeing stuff in real life is important, but the way that we interact with art on social media and online is also important. I think you can have two, you can have like an echo of an original artwork online, and it can be just as powerful as seeing it in real life. Especially if you have access to the artist, like that's exciting. I think, yeah, as we've sort of talked about in the last hour or so, I think like having that relationship with social media, but also like tempering, yeah, I think having some kind of a tempered relationship with it where you understand that it's its own thing and it's not necessarily, experiencing art in real life. But yeah, I think it's like the great sort of equalizer, isn't it? Like
You have power, and I feel like even with you talking about creating your own space and using a retail space and converting it into your own, however way you want to present your own world, your own gallery, you're not having to ask for permission, and that's something that I've been changing my mind a lot more recently about, like, who I apply to, or who I, even if it's just an online, like periodical, or if it's in for like a gallery or something. I'm so much more choosy now because it's better to have the power to do what you want, and then you're not asking someone for permission. It's only about the logistics, and I don't know. I think that's way cooler. Then you don't have to worry about like what they're looking for, or if it blends in with the other things that they have, and because I feel like that shouldn't matter as much, but
No, it shouldn't. And I think the way that galleries work now is that they are business models and they're based on consignment, and that for me really makes me feel like the gallerists don't believe in the work. And it makes me feel like the gallerists are making the artists do more work promoting their work, and less work just making art and like hearing stories from when my parents were my age and my dad was represented by a, gallery here in Melbourne. And the difference in the way that galleries worked even like 30 years ago, I'm like very skeptical of the gallery system here. I have friends who are represented and I don't know too much about how that all works, but I'm really not concerned with working with any galleries. I mean, I'm also not, I'm probably not like asked to be in that many shows or even probably known by very many gallerists. I don't, not really sure if I like, yeah, I haven't quite sort of cracked into that world, but I'm really not that concerned with being known by curators or gallerists.
I think that's better. Yeah, I think it's better, and it's like I think being represented can be cool, but not if you're like expecting it. And there's been places where I've submitted in the past where, and then like you pay like a fee, and you're again you're asking for permission, and then I decided to stop. I decided to only do like art calls if they were free, or if I could have control, which cut so much out of what I was applying for, but I thought that would be hard, and I realized I should have done that sooner. But then I was getting emails from people who had only rejected me, being like, "You haven't sent us anything this month, like do you?" Because they were looking for that fee money, and I was just like, "No, like you want to reject me, and like I'm not doing that." And it's not, even if you don't take it personally, it's still time that you're giving, and that can be towards your artwork, which is way, that's the whole point anyway. So I think that's smart.
There's something freeing. I think there's also other people who are taking it a step further and rejecting the institution of art school and creating their own collectives of, like little studios, and putting the money that they would have spent on going to school into that, and rejecting the institution, which I think is really interesting and cool. I really am interested to see what happens in the future, and how galleries learn to adapt to what artists want. I don't know if it's necessary. I think it'll probably just create two di very different worlds. It'll create, like, there'll be like a high art world and this underground. But yeah, I as I said, I'm not that concerned with being recognized or being curated into shows. Not that I would say no if anyone wants to curate me into a show,
Yeah,
but
totally.
I just haven't I mean, I have been included in stuff, and it's really, really nice to be asked to be in stuff, but it's not the be all end all. Like, I feel like you could make artwork and put it up in your house and then have people over for dinner, and that's just as satisfying as having it in a gallery and having 500 strangers see it in a week,
Yeah, I think it
I do
sounds more
want to just.
fun at home.
Yeah,
Then you can
it
have
is.
your food, and it's I don't know, it's more relaxing maybe too, but
Yeah, it is. It's nice. I think the best way to see an artist's artwork is in either their house or in a friend's house, because it's like the most personal sort of relationship. I also think that, like, when art is interacted with and when it's lived with, it sort of gains like a different meaning, or like a deeper, more enriched. I don't know. I really believe that, like, artworks that have been hung on the wall or displayed in some way for a long time have like a lot of power.
I think so too. It adds to the presence, and it's not something, you're not in a gallery where you're moving from piece to piece as much, and it's not as like clinical if it's in a regular gallery setting.
Yeah,
There's
like
more
it's
of a
a nice big
presence,
one.
and yeah.
Yeah. And, commercial galleries are good. They serve a purpose for, a certain, like, group of people and group of artists. But yeah, there's lots of different ways of showing your work. And I don't know. That said, I will probably have like a white box show this year.
Would be super, and watch you,
Maybe
like
I'll.
maybe you'll get signed after this too. You're gonna have multiple contracts.
Oh my God, maybe I'll get signed. I'll get signed to like a 10-year gallery deal. Yes.
Yeah,
All I have to do is manifest it.
exactly. Oh, cool. Well, I had so much fun talking to you, and I mean,
My God, me too.
there's so many things that you shared. Again, there's just so much joy I feel, and just in the way that you live and the way that you present your art making and the processes. So I love seeing when whatever it is that's popping up, when your four leaf clover finding is popping up, and that inspired me. I think that was why I finally found my first four leaf clover a couple
Oh,
years
really?
ago. And then like I just looked down and it was just there, and I was getting strummer out of the car, and he was still little. And then there's like a 2 or 3 year period, but I always thought of like you, and I think you said Casper in the recent
Yeah,
post found one.
Casper found his first one in August last year, and ever since then he finds them all the time. He's
Oh
beaten me,
wow.
stole my magic.
Oh no. That's so great.
Nah, he's just closer to the ground. But he has been he's just been finding them everywhere, and it's the best party trick because he said that he was at school and he was on the oval and found a four-leaf clover and gave it to his teacher, and his
Oh,
teacher
cool.
was so impressed. And I was like, it's the best party trick, it really is, because people either, if you find them and put photos up, or if you say you find them, people are like, oh yeah. But if you actually find one in the presence of somebody else and give it to them, that's the best. It's just the best, most impressive thing that you could do.
It's magical. There was a time where I had students, we were outside and we had like an extended, maybe it was a fire drill or something, we did an extended time, and I was looking at the ground. They're like, "What are you doing?" And I'm like, "I'm looking for four leaf clovers." And then all these groups of kids, and it just grew. Like there are all these rows and rows of kids just like looking at the grass, and they're all quiet and all calm. And there are teachers that are like, "How did you do this? Like, why are they all so content and happy?" And they're just like softly combing the grass. So it was super cool. Yeah.
Really, really nice grounding meditative, like mindfulness exercise. I find myself doing it basically, if I'm standing on grass, I will look for four-leaf clovers. But it is actually really nice. I once got asked if I was okay when I was on a nature strip. This guy walked past and he was like, "Are you all right?" And I was like, "Oh, I'm just looking for four-leaf clovers. I'm cool." But it was like
Yeah.
nice that he asked. I probably looked like I was about to vomit or something, but
It's you get lost in it, but it's so nice. It's so
yeah.
relaxing. So.
I love that image of all of the kids so calmly looking. That's the thing. Like sometimes people just need a little prompt to like do something like that, or like to connect with the ground, or not be, distracted by their phones or whatever. Oh, that makes me sound like such a wanker, but I'm always on
No,
my
I think
phone.
it's
I'm
good.
constantly on my phone. So.
Well, same here, but I mean it makes a difference to recognize and to have examples of other things you can do, 'cause I'm sure it makes a difference if you're thinking about it. So, well, cool. Well, I hope people listening become four leaf clover hunters, because that would be
Hope
really cool.
so
Maybe they
too.
can post their findings. I don't know.
Yeah.
But I'm excited to share your work, and I'm excited to share about the reasons behind the pieces that you chose. So I think this will be really cool to listen to.
I'm
But
so like, this has been such a lovely experience. Thank you so much for having me on your podcast. I'm a huge podcast listener, by the
oh,
way. So
cool.
it's really excited to be on your podcast and to listen to other people.
Yes,
Your
we're number 33 in Luxembourg. I don't know why,
podcast.
and I don't know what that means. So, hi to Luxembourg. But it's still a baby podcast. But everyone's been so cool to talk to you. So, and again, I always learn so much. So it's out of greed for me to learn from other people.
It's I think it shows a real enthusiasm for art and for life and for other people, that you are interested in speaking to people about their art. And yeah, I was very honored to be asked, so thank you.